Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time and hear stories from our greatest generation. The idea is to honor our World War II veterans for their service to our country, for the sacrifices that they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom still today. And along the way, there is a lot that we have to learn from these folks, often more than 90 years old, and that's the case today. Arlanda Ritchie of Fresno, California, isn't going to be 93 until September. And shortly after that, hopefully, he'll be on a flight headed to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. So some excitement to come. But let's go back to the excitement that was. You grew up, like a lot of veterans I meet here in California, in Oklahoma. What was it like in Oklahoma in the 1930s when you were growing up there?
Much different than it was is here now. We didn't have air conditioning, and we didn't have a lot of modern things that we enjoy now. We didn't have irrigation to raise our crops. We had to depend on the rain. Sometimes you'd get up pretty good, and then it would stop raining, so you had a bad year then. So a lot different.
Your parents separated when you were just 3 years old, so you were really raised by your grandparents. Did that seem any different to you than anything else?
No, my grandparents did a good job till I got up about 10, 11 years old, and I got out on my own because I went from here to there. I felt lost for security reasons. I had a lot of different feelings than people growing up with their parents. And I would go out and work a while and board someplace another with people, and eventually I'd wind up back with my grandparents when they had crops to gather. Well, I'd go back and help them gather crops. And that went on until we came to California. And then I just broke ties with them and went out on my own.
When you were 18 years old, you did something else that I guess had an impact on your life. You had no idea at that point how long you'd be wearing a uniform, but you put on your first military uniform with the Oklahoma National Guard in 1938. Why'd you do that?
Well, I wanted to earn money to buy myself some clothes. The farm money was real scarce back then, and work was scarce. No one had money to pay you, so you just helped each other out. So the guard paid $1.50 a night for one night at once, you know. And you got paid every 3 months. And 2 weeks summer camp in the summer, you got $1.50 a day for that time. So that was a pretty good payday then, which I served one summer camp at Fort Sam Houston, Texas. Then I got out of the guard and came to California.
And joined the Army, because I guess you liked wearing a uniform, huh? You joined the Army before America entered World War II. What was the thinking there to join the U.S. Army in 1940?
Well, I had no direction in my life, so I just knew I needed to go. So I needed to have some kind of a direction to go. So I figured the Army was the best place, and they fed me and boarded me and furnished my clothes. And they furnished my work, and I thought it's probably the worst mistake I'd made about 3 weeks after I was in there. Went through basic training, and man, I thought I was really screwed up, you know. But after that, I knew that they cared about me, and they gave me a direction in life. They took care of that pretty well.
But for a while, you didn't know if you were going to make it?
It was a while I didn't know if I was going to make it. But after a few weeks, then I began to fall into the groove, you know. I knew what was going to happen. The old-timers back there then, they come out straight out of China. The regiment had been over there for several years, and they called you and said, you're not even a human being, you know. That basic training was rough. They just dehumanized you, and pretty soon you got to thinking maybe that's right, you know. But after a while, you fell into it, and then you got to liking it. And the guys that give you a hard time turned out to be your best friends after basic training. But they really was rough on you then.
Well, and I'm curious what this did to change that dynamic, because something happened in December of 1941 that seemed to get everybody on the same page real quick. You were up in the Pacific Northwest, Fort Lewis, Washington, when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor?
Right, which Fort Lewis, Washington.
What do you remember about that? How did you find out, and what did it mean to you?
Well, it came over the radio on December the 7th, and of course, right away, we got busy and went on 48-hour alert, and we had to sleep in our clothes and everything, and my battalion was sent to Seattle to check out the Japanese population there, and we found that they had radios going straight to Tokyo. There's a lot of good Japanese people, too, there, but everyone is treated alike then. So they picked them up. That turned out to be a real tough job.
What'd you have to do?
Well, you had to go in and bring them out and send them back to headquarters, and they'd be interrogated there, and then going back to send them to some camps here in the States.
So just in the days following Pearl Harbor, you were rounding up Japanese Americans and sending them off to interrogation.
That's right, and many of the Japanese population was very good American citizens. I thought that that should have been probably arranged a little bit differently, but our president, he felt differently about it, and he was the boss, so everyone had to do what he said, and I felt bad about rounding up a lot of good Japanese people. I thought this an injustice to the good American people that was already American citizens.
So you had some actually pretty interesting duty domestically in the States before you ever went overseas. There was another situation that you encountered. You'd been moved out here to California. You're at Camp Hunter Liggett, and there was a situation in Southern California that you guys got called in on. What was that all about?
There was a strike down at North American Aviation plant there, and they're building P-51s, fighter planes, and our president decided they'd put them back to work, so he sent their 1st Battalion, the 15th Infantry, down there to take care of that, and we landed somewhere around Ventura and got together, made our plans, and went in there 3 deep on the striking force. There was about 20,000 strikers there. Everyone was working at North America, it seemed like, everyone in California. But we broke it up as we fixed bayonets and went in on them. And a few of them were stuck a little bit in the bayonets, some blood, but no casualties. And after about 6 weeks, well, they decided they'd go ahead and build airplanes.
Can you imagine if something like that happened today, how it would be received in this country if the U.S. Army got sent in on 20,000 American workers who were striking?
I can't imagine what would happen. I don't believe that they would probably be as security interested in it as it would be then, you know. This war was fresh and everyone was patriotic, you know. I guess it'd be a lot different now, though. I'm pretty sure it would be. I don't think it'd get the Guard or the Army would be very interested in getting that done, you know.
What was that like for you? Did you come in contact with some of these strikers? Did you have to get physical with them at all, or what were your duties there?
I had to punch one in the butt with a bayonet. I'd hate to do it, but he just was gonna strike me, you know, so I just stuck a bayonet in him a little bit, and then he moved out. It's kind of hard to explain exactly how you felt about it. You knew people was working too cheap, and they wanted more money, and more money was being had out there. I don't think I could do that now.
But when you signed up in the Army, you certainly didn't plan on fighting against Americans.
No, I did not. I did not figure on anything like that. You have to sign an oath that you have to defend America, whatever happens, so that's what happened.
Yeah, and eventually you would be overseas fighting a very different enemy. But in the meantime, your training continued. I understand you went back to Fort Lewis. You got promoted to corporal, and you ended up on a machine gun crew. What kind of machine gun?
Air-cooled machine gun. They made me corporal, and I had 7 men, a gunner, an assistant gunner, and 5 ammunition carriers. And I thought that was a tough job, but it really wasn't.
Well, and I'll ask you more about that, but I'm pretty sure chronologically that somewhere in here in 1942, you had something else very important to your life happen, because it certainly has changed the last 71 years of your life. How is it that you met this teenage girl named Margaret out in Arvin, California?
We was playing out in the streets there in a little country village there, and I was batting the ball, and she was trying to catch it, and I'd say, well, you missed that one, so she had all actually caught it, but I was trying to favor her a little bit, and pretty soon while we got to talking, and then we went out on a show date there, and I actually put my hand over on her leg, and she slapped me, and I thought, well, this is the one I'm going to marry. So that's actually the way it started, and then engagement got more serious as it moved along, and we got married in 1942. She promised she'd meet me wherever I went, so I went to Camp Rooker, Alabama on a training cruise, training the 81st Infantry Division. That's when she came down to, we got married there then.
But you make that sound real easy, and from what I understand, it wasn't very easy, because you had to go to your boss, your company commander, and ask a little favor, right?
You had to ask permission to get married in. It was one of the rules that you had to follow. And I had to go ask him, which is a very tough thing to do. And he said, well, so let me think about it. So a day or two later, he said, well, I thought about it. Says, I decided I'd let you get married the first time you asked. But said I had to discuss it with all the officers. Says everyone in the company knew it before I did. And I got a little aggravated at him. But I said, well, you got about 2 days to make up your mind because my wife's on the way down here, and we're going to get married whether you okay it or not.
He made you sweat a little bit.
Yeah, he made me sweat.
And, well, I guess that story of your actual wedding is interesting, too. Most people, if they've been married to someone for 71 years, they only have one anniversary, but you have two. How is that possible?
Well, she arrived by train down there about 10 o'clock in Ozark, Alabama. I borrowed my neighbor's car and went and picked her up, and we called a minister to come in and perform the wedding, and he was a little late, so we started about 5 minutes to 11 and ended up after 12. So that's the reason we have two dates in our anniversary. Then we got in the car, and there's a lady there that was renting from, put Margaret and I in the back seat, but she got in between us. We went to Panama Beach for a little one-night honeymoon. Got down there, and they always tried to keep us apart there for the time. And I went to, we got back to Panama Beach, but I had to go back to camp, and I didn't get back home until Wednesday night of the next week. So you had to, you got to come home once a week in the weekends if you wasn't on duty. So my bride was in a place I'd rented for $25 a month, which is almost more than I made. But then I got to see her on the Wednesday. From then on, it's just about like that. We fell into a pattern, you know, Wednesday and weekends. If I had duty on the weekends, I'd try to get one of my buddies to do the weekend duty for me, which worked out all right.
Well, but that routine would get shaken up a little bit when Uncle Sam decided to send you overseas, and you had been, I guess, part of the 81st Infantry Division. Then they formed a new division and put you in it?
I stayed with the 81st about 19 months, about 20 months, and they formed the 87th Division, and they picked that cadre out of the 81st, formed the 87th, and I was picked for that. There's three of us guys that went down on the original cadre from the 3rd Division to the 81st. I was picked for the 87th then. I thought, man, when is this going to end? I trained a lot of troops during that time, and you'd get them trained where they really is about halfway, could do their job, and then they'd pick them out to send them overseas. You knew they wasn't trained. You hated to send them off house over there to get killed, you know, but you knew that's going to happen. You had no choice. They'd pick them out, and you had to stay where they went.
And you were training them specifically on machine guns?
I was trained on 60-millimeter mortars and a machine gun. 60-millimeter mortars is kind of like a artillery, only you carry it with a hand, you know, and put projectiles in it, and it goes over there, and you estimate the range and so forth.
So you're concerned about all these other guys getting sent over without sufficient training, but I guess the plus side for you was all that time gave you plenty of training for your eventual deployment.
Oh, man, I was overtrained. It was a hard job doing that. It's repetitious, you know, repetitious. You'd get a group of troops trained, and they'd lose them, and then you'd get to start all over again. So it got to be very tiresome. I was kind of glad when they sent me overseas.
Of course, though, the reason that they sent you overseas is they had so many losses over there before you got there, right? I mean, you went over in October of 1944, so they'd already made the landings at Normandy, and they'd suffered some heavy casualties. Did that weigh on your mind as you were heading overseas?
Yeah, it did, very heavily, you know. One night we went to bed, we was on the front line then, and had the machine guns dug in. The weather was terrible. We was fighting two enemies over there, the weather and the enemy. And dark time came, and we got a word that was going to break through. So we sat there, kept our machine gun handy, and every once in a while they did this psychology thing on us, you know, screaming and hollering and trawling for this guy and that guy, you know. So next morning, well, it got daylight again, and that guy was with me, McGee. His hair was just as white as snow. That had really psyched him out, you know, that night. He just couldn't handle it. After the next day or two, he got bushed off. Things like that hurt you pretty bad. You're stuck with the people you go over there with, but the new ones come in while you avoid friendship. You avoid close friendship with them.
Because you don't want to have to deal with the emotions of loss?
No, it's hard to deal with that. I still have nightmares after all this time. I guess your subconscious kicks in or something you do. There's no way to explain it.
Not to prolong that painful thought for you, but I want to touch on something you said. What color was McGee's hair to begin with?
Black. It looked like it's just laying in curls on his head, you know. Real curly and real pretty hair. Well, during the night, the black curls turned to white curls.
Because of the scare tactics?
Stress factor or scare factor or something. And there's metabolism in his body just turned him into that, I guess. Wow.
Yeah, I could see how that would get your attention. I want to backtrack a little bit with you, because I imagine you're a young man. I guess at this point, you're 24 years old when you're shipping out. An old man by Army standards at that time compared to some of these other guys. But you're leaving behind your young wife, not knowing if you're ever going to see her again. What was that like? How hard was that to ship out?
Real hard. I had a young son then, too. I wanted to leave something behind, you know, which was very unfair to my wife, leaving her the responsibility of a young son or a young child. And I worried some about that. But after I got over there, I went 9 months exactly. I didn't hear a word from my wife. I thought, oh, man, dear John, you know, or something like that. And other guys was getting mail, but I wasn't getting no mail for 9 months. And I just, so that's when I sort of went goofy. Every dangerous thing come up, well, I'd volunteer for it. And that's how I got lost and behind the lines, because I volunteered too much and got careless, and just got to where I really didn't care. I just really didn't care.
Wow, that's so raw and so real, and I so appreciate your candor and your willingness to share that with us. I want to ask you again about your mindset in leaving, and you mentioned in retrospect you can see what it must have been like for her with a young son and all that, but did you believe as you left that you would see her again, or were you afraid that you never would?
I didn't know. I really didn't know. I was laying beside people, and you did, you know, and I wondered if the next one meant for me, but all I got out of it was shrapnel wounds, and the worst thing happened to me, and my feet froze. There's no way you can prevent that. They say change socks every day. Well, the socks you had on was wet. You take them off and wring them out and put them in next to your body, you know, to try to get them warm and halfway dry again to put them on the next day. Well, that didn't work all the time either, so my feet finally froze. And I wasn't the only one it happened to. Weather, we didn't have living conditions was terrible for the infantrymen. You had foxholes, and it's wet. And you froze up during the night, and it is terrible. I can't explain exactly what it's all about.
Well, I think you're giving us a pretty good glimpse of what it was like to be in the infantry in Europe and even in the Battle of the Bulge. Before I forget, though, I want to thank the Madera Rotary Club for an unforgettable moment earlier this week when a World War II veteran named Ted Sanderson learned Madera Rotary would be sponsoring his journey to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. A big mahalo to President Wren Hallett and all you generous Rotarians. If you'd like to follow their lead and help our veterans experience the World War II Memorial, find out all about that quest at cvhonorflight.org. You can sign up veterans for the trip there, and you can apply to be a guardian. We need able-bodied folks to go and push our veterans around in wheelchairs, so sign up for that too. Time right now to hear how one of our sponsors is helping that cause. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Our World War II veterans deserve a chance to see their memorial in Washington, D.C., and you can help send them there simply by renting a car. Between now and the end of October, visit any Enterprise Rent-A-Car location from Bakersfield in the south to Tulare, Visalia, Hanford, Selma, Fresno, Madera, Merced, all the way north to Sacramento. Tell them you heard this ad on Hometown Heroes, and Enterprise will donate 10% of your rental to Central Valley Honor Flight. Restrictions may apply. I'm sure you're familiar with Enterprise, but do you know why the largest car rental company in the U.S. is called Enterprise? The company's founder, Jack Taylor, was a decorated F-6F Hellcat pilot in World War II, flying off the deck of the Big E, the aircraft carrier USS Enterprise. Maybe I should get him on the show sometime and he can tell us how he earned the Distinguished Flying Cross. In the meantime, choose Enterprise for your next rental. Tell him you heard this advertisement on Hometown Heroes, and you'll be helping to send our World War II veterans on one more tour with honor.